Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello again and welcome back. We come to you 7 days a week with interesting stories from around the world. If you are learning American English, you have come to the right place because we always present our stories slowly so they are easier to understand. And we use fewer words, easy words, that make your learning experience more fun. Today we have two stories for you. The first is about food, a healthy diet, and exercise. Many young Americans are leading the effort to help school children all across this country. Then we will introduce you to an American boy who loves to play music, even though he has disabilities that most musicians do not have. This story will make you feel good inside. If you are ready, let's listen and learn with part one of As It Is. Our story begins at the John Burroughs Elementary School in Washington, D.C. The school's kindergarten students are staying late today, an hour after classes normally end. The boys and girls are not seeking help with reading skills or mathematics. They instead are tasting kale, a vegetable that many of them are eating for the first time. Student Robert Smith says it tastes good as he eats the green leaves with olive oil on them. The school's teachers are also learning about eating healthier. Dion Hamill says she has been encouraged to eat vegetables she never thought she would like.
The kale especially is like, no thank you. So she said, try this way. Oh, I like it. So I went home and started making kale for myself.
Ms. Hamill says her students have learned healthy eating habits from the program. She hopes they will keep a healthy diet for the rest of their lives. The program is taught by young people like Karen Davison. She is a member of Food Corps. The nonprofit group gets money from the AmeriCorps National Service Program. Since the beginning of the school year, Ms. Davison has spent each day in this Washington, D.C. classroom. She gives the kindergartners vegetables that many of them have never tasted. She teaches them where their food comes from and how they can choose to eat healthier meals.
They see a lot of packaged food. If they eat vegetables, they're not necessarily fresh, they're not necessarily whole. And so being able to bring in fresh, whole vegetables, leafy greens, interesting fruit, is really a great experience for these students.
Food Corps was launched 5 years ago. It sends more than 180 young Americans to 500 schools across the United States. The young people teach students about nutrition and how they can eat healthy foods both at school and at home. Food Corps also works with other groups to plant vegetable gardens in schools and bring healthier foods to stores, especially stores in cities. Many small urban stores often sell only packaged foods. Maddie Morales is a member of Food Corps. She says the group's work is especially important in the fight against childhood obesity, when a child has too much body fat. She notes that the child obesity rate in the United States is twice what it was 30 years ago.
The repercussions of having an unhealthy population is just absolutely unacceptable and really scary in some ways, that it affects our national security, it affects our ability to be a productive country, and it is imperative that we change the system.
In January, President Barack Obama's wife, Michelle, asked Food Corps co-founder Deborah Eschmeyer to lead the government's Let's Move program. The goal of the program is to reduce childhood obesity through healthy eating and exercise. In a statement, Mrs. Obama said, "Ms. Eschmeyer has taught children about the importance of healthy eating for more than 10 years.
She said, from classrooms and gardens to kitchens and farms, Deb has made learning about nutrition fun and accessible for kids across the country. Ms. Eschmeyer joined Mrs. Obama at the White House kitchen garden planting in April. At the event, Mrs. Obama also marked the fifth year since the beginning of the Let's Move program. Mrs. Obama and students from around the country planted spinach, radishes, bok choy, broccoli, and lettuce. She urged people to plant their own vegetables and tell on social media five things they are doing to lead healthier lives.
Let's share our progress because we're going to come back and harvest in a few months, and I'd love to see what other community gardens and schools, school gardens are doing out there to move forward on getting our kids to eat healthy.
Mrs. Obama began Let's Move in February 2010. She said she was worried about increasing obesity levels among American children. As obesity levels increase, so do the risks of diabetes, heart disease, and asthma. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says more than one-third of American children and adolescents are overweight or obese. The number is even higher among African American and Hispanic youth. Mrs. Obama has worked to put healthier foods in schools and urged young people to exercise. And she has partnered with large companies like Nike, which makes athletic clothing and running shoes. I'm Jim Tedder.
You are listening to The Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. Now, Kelly Jean Kelly joins us with the story of a special youngster who has a special talent, even though he cannot see.
Ready, buddy?
Yeah.
Here we go.
When Frankie Moran first saw his son, Cole, he could not imagine ever sharing his love of music with the boy. Cole had cognitive delays and other birth defects, and he was blind.
When he was born, I didn't see any eyes like how we have eyes. And my heart sank.
But Cole was not deaf and quickly showed an interest in music. Mr. Moran is a singer and songwriter. He says his son liked to be nearby when he was making music at home. He says Cole would touch the instruments. At around the age of one, Cole started playing notes of simple songs on a toy piano.
That's about the same time we discovered he had perfect pitch, because when he would miss a note and hit the wrong note in, you know, a melody like Twinkle Twinkle Little Star, he would go back and find that note. So that's how we figured he knew what he was hearing.
Cole Moran is now 12 years old. Cole plays music every day. He records his performances and listens back to the sound. He enjoys the work.
Happy. When I play music, I am happy.
Cole's choice of instrument since he was four has been the harmonica, which he often plays with his dad. Last year, the father and son duo won second place at a fiddler's convention in their hometown, Berlin, Maryland. Now and then, Cole performs with his father under the name Blind Wind at a restaurant in Berlin. The 12-year-old released his first CD recently. His mother, Jenny Moran, was excited.
It's wonderful that he has something that he can do for the rest of his life that he'll always enjoy.
Cole attends Maryland School for the Blind in Baltimore. There will be lots of time for music when classes end for the summer break. Frankie Moran says he and Cole plan to hit the road. They want to do a series of Blind Wind performances around the country. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
You are listening to As It Is from the Learning English Office at the Voice of America, Washington. Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Economics Report. Chinese investment in Australia has moved to the real estate market and infrastructure. It is yet another sign that Australia's once strong mining industry is weakening as Chinese business looks for new places to invest. For the first time, almost half of all Chinese investment in Australia is in real estate. Spending on roads, bridges, and other infrastructure has also increased. Private businesses from China are also investing more than state-owned enterprises. The findings are contained in a report called Demystifying Chinese Investment in Australia. It comes from accounting company KPMG Australia, the University of Sydney Business School, and the China Studies Center. Hans Hendrischke is a professor of Chinese business and management at the University of Sydney Business School. He says the study provides examples of what he calls new patterns of interest. Australia's mining industry was expanding a few years ago. Now, the rate of growth appears to be slowing. Chinese companies with money to spend have looked to real estate as a place to invest. However, Australia's Foreign Investment Review Board must approve what properties the companies can buy. Phil Harris is the managing director of Harris Real Estate in Adelaide. He says Chinese buyers are inflating prices in Australia's major cities. Last year, the Chinese invested $8.3 billion in Australia. The combination of real estate, leisure, and infrastructure projects made up 79% of new Chinese business in the country. That compares with just 11% for mining. While real estate is the most popular investment, there is growing interest, too, in Australian agriculture. Andrew Forrest got rich from the mining business. He says Chinese investment is helping to increase the productivity of farming.
So far, Chinese investment into Australia agriculture has been well received, and they're capable of being a strong and passive partner in projects of massive scale, which our capital alone could not develop.
The falling value of the Australian dollar has made investments in the country more appealing. Easing of Australian visa rules has also attracted investment. Doug Ferguson is head of KPMG Australia's Asia Business Group. He co-wrote the report on China's investment in Australia. He says Chinese investment is good news. China is the sixth largest foreign investor in Australia. The United States and Britain invest more, although Chinese spending is growing fastest. The flow of money from China is a politically sensitive issue, especially purchases of real estate and farms. Last weekend, Australian nationalists demonstrated and burned flags near China's diplomatic offices in Sydney. they were protesting what they described as a foreign invasion. And that's the VOA Learning English Economics Report. I'm Mario Ritter.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. Today we tell about the Korean War. The biggest problem facing Dwight Eisenhower when he became President of the United States was the continuing conflict in Korea. Eisenhower was elected in November 1952. At the time, the United States had been helping South Korea fight North Korea for more than 2 years. About 20 other members of the United Nations were also helping the South. The UN members provided troops, equipment, and medical aid.
I shall go to Korea.
During the American presidential election campaign, Eisenhower announced that he would go to Korea. He thought such a trip would help end the war. Eisenhower kept his promise. He went to Korea after he won the election, but before he was sworn in as president. Yet the fighting did not stop in Korea until July of the next year, 1953. The war started when North Korean troops invaded South Korea. Both sides believed they should control all of the country. The dream of a united Korea was a powerful one. From 1910 until World War II, Korea had been under Japanese rule. In an agreement at the end of the war, troops from the Soviet Union occupied the North. They accepted the surrender of Japanese troops and set up a military government. American troops did the same in the South. The border dividing North and South was the geographic line known as the 38th parallel. A few years later, the United Nations General Assembly ordered free elections for all of Korea. With UN help, the South established the Republic of Korea. Syngman Rhee was elected the first president. On the other side of the 38th parallel, however, Soviet troops refused to let UN election officials enter the North. The Soviet Union supported the creation of a communist government there called the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. Kim Il-sung was named premier. Five years after the end of World War II, the United States had withdrawn almost all of its troops from South Korea. It was not clear if America would defend the South from attack. South Korea had an army, but it was smaller and less powerful than the North Korean army. North Korea decided the time was right to invade. On June 25, 1950, North Korean soldiers crossed the 38th parallel. The UN Security Council demanded that they go back. 2 days later, the Council approved military support for South Korea. The Soviet delegate boycotted the meeting that day. If he had been present, the resolution would have been defeated. The UN demand did not stop the North Korean troops. They continued to push south. In a week, they were at the edge of the capital, Seoul. Harry Truman, America's president at that time, ordered air and sea support for South Korea. A few days later, he announced that American ground forces would also be sent. Truman wanted an American to command UN troops in Korea. The UN approved his choice, General Douglas MacArthur. Week after week, more UN forces arrived in the South. Yet by August, they had been pushed back to the Pusan perimeter. This was a battle line around an area near the city of Pusan in the southeast corner of Korea. North Korean forces attempted to break through the Pusan perimeter. They began a major attack on August 6th. They lost many men, however, and by the end of the month, they withdrew. The next month, General MacArthur directed a surprise landing of American Marines in South Korea. They arrived at the port of Incheon on the northwest coast. The landing was extremely dangerous. Water levels could rise or fall as much as 9 meters in a single day. The boats had to get close to the coastline and land at high tide. If they waited too long, the water level would drop and they would be trapped in the mud with little protection. The soldiers on the boats would be easy targets. The landing at Incheon was successful. The additional troops quickly divided the North Korean forces, which had been stretched from north to south. At the same time, UN air and sea power destroyed the Northern Army's lines of communication. On October 1st, South Korean troops entered North Korea. They captured the capital, Pyongyang. Then they moved toward the Yalu River, the border between North Korea and China. China warned against moving closer to the border. General MacArthur ordered the troops to continue their attacks. He repeatedly said he did not believe that China would enter the war in force. MacArthur was wrong. Several hundred thousand Chinese soldiers crossed into North Korea in October and November. Still, MacArthur thought the war would end by December 25th, the Christmas holiday. This was not to happen. The UN troops were forced to withdraw from Pyongyang. And by the day before Christmas, there had been a huge withdrawal by sea from the coastal city of Hongnam. In the first days of 1951, the North Koreans recaptured Seoul. The UN troops withdrew about 40 kilometers south of the city. They reorganized and 2 months later regained control of Seoul. Then the war changed. The two sides began fighting in an area north of the 38th parallel. They exchanged control of the same territory over and over again. Men were dying, but no one was winning. The cost in lives was huge. General MacArthur had wanted to enter China and attack Manchuria. He also had wanted to use nationalist Chinese troops against the communists. President Truman feared that these actions might start another world war.
If we do have another world war, it will be an atomic war. We could expect many atomic bombs to be dropped on American cities, and a single one of them could cause many more times the casualties than we have suffered in all the fighting in Korea. I do not want to be responsible for bringing that about.
When MacArthur disagreed in public with the president's policies on Korea, including the general's statement, "There is no substitute for victory," Truman dismissed MacArthur.
"It was with the deepest personal regret that I found myself compelled to take this action. General MacArthur is one of our greatest military commanders, but the cause of world peace is much more important than any individual."
In June 1951, the Soviet delegate to the United Nations proposed a ceasefire for Korea. Peace talks began, first at Kaesong, then at Panmunjom. By November, hope for a settlement was strong. But negotiators could not agree about several issues, including the return of prisoners. The UN demanded that prisoners of war be permitted to choose if they wanted to go home. The different issues could not be settled after more than a year. Finally, in November 1952, the peace talks were suspended. Fighting continued during the negotiations. As it did, President Truman lost support. This was one reason why he decided not to seek re-election. The new president, Dwight Eisenhower, took office in January 1953. Eisenhower had campaigned to end the war. He was willing to take strong action to do this. Years later, he wrote that he secretly threatened to expand the war and use nuclear weapons if the Soviets did not help restart the peace talks. Such measures were not necessary. In a few months, North Korea accepted an earlier UN offer to trade prisoners who were sick or wounded. The two sides finally signed an armistice agreement on July 27, 1953. The agreement stopped the fighting and provided for the exchange of about 90,000 prisoners of war. It also permitted prisoners to choose if they wanted to go home. The war in Korea damaged almost all of the country. As many as 2 million people may have died, including many civilians. After the war, the United States provided hundreds of thousands of soldiers to help the South guard against attack from the North. Half a century has passed since the truce, yet Korea is still divided, and many of the same issues still threaten the Korean people and the world. The Korean conflict increased efforts in the United States to develop a weapon more deadly than the atomic bombs that had been used against Japan to end World War II. These efforts led to the hydrogen bomb. The Soviets were developing such a weapon, too. They had already developed and tested an atomic bomb. The 1950s found Americans at home feeling hopeful about the economic future while also living under the threat of nuclear war. That will be our story next week. You can find our series online with transcripts, MP3s, podcasts, and pictures at voaspecialenglish.com. And you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at VOA Learning English. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English.